hands in that direction, heaven forbid. But she did want him to see the pictures, and to tell her what she had wrong, which she was sure must be a great deal. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper also hoped for his opinion. Looking at these pictures had given him a feeling which was strange yet eerily intangible. It had been like looking at photographs of his own imagination, and he knew from that moment on, whenever he tried to imagine Misery's little combination parlor and study, Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper's Polaroids would leap immediately into his mind, obscuring imagination with their cheery but one-dimensional concreteness. Tell her what was wrong? That was madness. From now on, he would be the one to wonder about that. He had written back, a brief note of congratulations and admiration, a note which hinted not at all at certain questions concerning Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper which had crossed his mind. How tightly wrapped was she, for instance? And had received another letter in return, with a fresh slew of Polaroids. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper's first communication had consisted of a 2-page handwritten letter and 7 Polaroids. His second consisted of a 10-page handwritten letter and 40 Polaroids. The letter was an exhaustive and ultimately exhausting manual of where Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper had found each piece, how much she had paid, and the restoration processes involved. Mrs. Roman D. Virginia Sandpiper...
Height. And you know what really pisses me off? She didn't need an answer. He's right. About all of it. And I know he's right. If a detective had brought me a case like this, I would have turned him away. There's nothing in the way of proof. Even if I know it's him. Margolis will check into it. So what? Margolis may be an ass, but he's smart. He'll get Lester to say something incriminating. And then what? You think Margolis will convince him to stop? I thought it was over when I moved here, but even that didn't end it. He knows where I live, and for all I know, Lester killed Coppo. He might have been inside my parents' house. It was the first time that Colin had heard her link Coppo's death to everything else that had occurred, and her obvious fear made something coil inside him. This was going to stop. Let Margolis do whatever he was going to do, but...
Johnson, when I met her, and I was in business with him a while. He and I, Meg and Evie, used to get together Saturday nights for pinochle and beer or such, and after a while, we traded legal and proper and through the courts when Meg decided that she...
...expression from gray to black. Colin followed her gaze, neither of them speaking for a moment. What kind of trouble? She finally asked. He lifted the tip of his reel, jerking the line before answering. Fights, he said. For a moment, she wasn't sure she'd heard him right. You used to fight in bars? Up until...
Veneers. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck. We'd left Sarasota in the dead of summer, right after my 10th birthday, and headed west under low, flickering skies that turned black and exploded and cleared just long enough to leave the air gauzy with steam. We drove through Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, stopping to cool the engine in towns where people moved with arthritic slowness and spoke in thick, strangled tongues. Idlers with rotten teeth surrounded the car to press peanuts on the pretty Yankee lady and her little boy, arguing among themselves about shortcuts. Women looked up from their flower beds as we drove past, or watched us from their porches, sometimes impassively, sometimes giving us a nod and a flutter of their fans. Every couple of hours, the Nash Rambler boiled over. My mother kept digging into her little grub stake, but no mechanic could fix it. All we could do was wait for it to cool, then drive on until it boiled over again. my mother came to hate this machine so much that not long after we got to Utah, she gave it away to a woman she met in a cafeteria. At night, we slept in boggy rooms where headlight beams crawled up and down the walls and mosquitoes sang in our ears, incessant as the tires whining on the highway outside. But none of this bothered me. I was caught up in my mother's freedom, her delight in her freedom, her dream of transformation. Everything was going to change when we got out west. My mother had been a girl in Beverly Hills, and the life we saw ahead of us was conjured from her memories of California in the days before the crash. Her father, Daddy, as she called him, had been a Navy officer and a paper millionaire. They lived in a big house with a turret. Just before Daddy lost all his money, and all his shanty Irish relatives' money, and got himself transferred overseas, my mother was one of four girls chosen to ride on the Beverly Hills float in the Tournament of Roses. The float's theme was The End of the Rainbow, and it won that year's prize by acclamation. She met Jackie Coogan. She had her picture taken with Harold Lloyd and Marion Davies, whose movie The Sailor Man was filmed on Daddy's ship. When Daddy was at sea, she and her mother lived a dream life in which, for days at a time, they played the part of sisters. And the cars my mother told me about.
He knew that Evan would have shaken his head at the way Colin had answered her questions. But aside from Colin...
And then she turned back, brushing absently at her hair again.
I did that with my book. Only I didn't really use threads, you know. I used hairs from my own head. I put them across the thickness of the book in three different places, and when I came in this morning, very early, creeping like a little mousie so I wouldn't wake you up, all three threads were broken. So I knew you'd been looking at my book.
She paused and smiled. It was, for Annie, a very winning smile, yet it had an unpleasant quality he could not quite put his finger on.
Not that I was surprised. I knew you'd been out of the room. That's the bad news. I've known for a long, long time, Paul.
He should feel angry and dismayed, he supposed. She had known, known almost from the start, it seemed. But he could only feel that dreamy, floating euphoria, and what she was saying did not seem nearly as important as the glorious quality of the strengthening light, as the day hovered on the edge of becoming.
But, she said with the air of one returning to business, we were talking about your car. I have studded tires, Paul, and at my place in the hills I keep a set of 10X tire chains. Early yesterday afternoon I felt ever so much better. I spent most of my time up there on my knees, deep in prayer. And the answer came, as it often does, and it was quite simple, as it often is. What you take to the Lord in prayer, Paul, he giveth back a thousandfold. So I put the chains on and I crept back down here. It was not easy, and I knew I might well have an accident in spite of the studs and the chains. I also knew that there is rarely such a thing as a minor accident on those twisty up-country roads. But I felt easy in my mind, because I felt safe in the will of the Lord. That's very uplifting, Annie, Paul croaked.
She gave him a look which was momentarily startled and narrowly suspicious.
His desire to be honest. What Evan didn't understand was that trying to hide the truth about his past was futile, even if he wanted to keep it hidden. People were both curious and cautious, and he knew that a quick internet search using his name would yield a handful of newspaper articles about him, none of them good. And if he hadn't laid it out there from the beginning, either Maria or Serena might have Googled him in the same way Victoria had. He'd met Victoria at a gym a couple of years ago, and after chatting off and on for a few months, they'd fallen into occasionally working out together. He'd thought that they were getting along well and considered her a good training partner until she suddenly began to avoid him. She'd stopped returning his texts or calls and started working out in the morning instead of the evenings. When he was finally able to talk to her, she'd revealed what she'd learned about him and insisted that he stop trying to contact her. She hadn't been interested in excuses, and Colin hadn't offered any. But he did wonder why she'd conducted her internet research in the first place.
Letters in my favorite writer's name. It's two of the letters in my favorite nurse's name. Her smile became a glow. Incredibly, a blush rose in her solid cheeks. That's what it would look like, he thought, if you built a furnace inside the mouth of one of those idols in the H.R. Rider Haggard stories. That is what it would look like at night.
You fooler, she simpered.
I'm not, he said, not at all.
Well.
She looked off for a moment, not blank, but just pleased, a little flustered, taking a moment to gather her thoughts. Paul could have taken some pleasure in the way this was going, if not for the weight of the typewriter, as solid as the woman and also damaged. It sat there, grinning with its missing tooth, promising trouble.
The wheelchair was much more expensive, she said. Ostomy supplies have gone right out of sight since I...
She broke off, frowned, cleared her throat. Then she looked back at him, smiling.
But it's time you began sitting up, and I don't begrudge the cost one tiny bit. And of course you can't type lying down, can you?
No.
I've got a board. I cut it to size. And paper. Weight.
She dashed from the room like a girl, leaving Paul and the typewriter to regard each other. His grin disappeared the moment her back was turned. The royals never varied. He supposed later that he had pretty well known what all this was about, just as he supposed he had known what the typewriter would sound like, how it would clack through its grin like that old comic strip character, Ducky Daddles. She came back with a package of Carassable Bond and shrink wrap, and a board about 3 feet wide by 4 feet long.
Look!
She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair that stood by his bed, like some solemn skeletal visitor. Already he could see the ghost of himself behind that board, pent in like a prisoner. She put the typewriter on the board.
So then, she continued. I'll say the policeman wrote it all down in his book and thanked me.
It wasn't as though they'd been dating. He wasn't sure they'd even reached the friendship stage yet. A month later, she'd stopped coming to the gym at all, and that was the last he'd seen of her. She hadn't been the only one who'd shied away after learning the truth about Colin, and while Evan might joke that Colin immediately volunteered his full history to anyone who asked, it wasn't like that. It generally wasn't anyone else's business, and he kept it that way, unless someone was, or might become, part of his life somehow. Though it was way too early to tell whether Maria fell into that category, Serena was a classmate, and if she'd talked to him once, she just might talk to him again. He admitted that there was something about Maria that interested him, however. Part of it was the way she looked, of course. She was a more mature, more striking version of Serena, with the same dark hair and eyes. But at the bar, he'd noted her lack of vanity. Though she'd drawn stares from any number of men on the rooftop, she hadn't been aware of it.
I'll say I asked him in for a cup of coffee, even though I was in a hurry to be on my way, and they'll ask me why. I'll say he probably knew about my trouble before, and I wanted to satisfy his mind that everything was on the up and up here. But he said no, we had to move along. So I asked if he'd like to take a cold Pepsi along with him, because the day was so hot. And he said, yes, thanks, that was very kind.
She drained her second Pepsi and held the empty plastic bottle between her and him. Seen through the plastic, her eye was huge and wavering, the eye of a cyclops. The side of her head took on a ripply, hydrocephalic bulge.
I'm going to stop and put this bottle in the ditch about 2 miles up the road, she said.
He had the tumbler twice, but both times the bobby pin slipped off, and the tumbler snapped back before he could do more than begin to move it. The bobby pin was starting to bend. He thought that it would break after another 2 or 3 tries.
Please God, he said, sliding it in again. Please God, what do you say? Just a little break for the kid, that's all I'm asking.
Board facing the ghost, and put the package of Carassable Bond, the paper he hated most in all the world because of the way the type blurred when the pages were shuffled together, beside it. She had now created a kind of cripple's study.
What do you think?
It looks good, he said, uttering the biggest lie of his life with perfect ease, and then asked the question to which he already knew the answer. What will I write there, do you think?
Oh, but Paul,
she said, turning to him, her eyes dancing animatedly in her flushed face.
I don't think. I know. You're going to use this typewriter to write a new novel. Your best novel. Misery's Return.
Misery's Return. He felt nothing at all. He supposed a man who had just cut his hand off in a power saw might feel the same species of nothing as he stood regarding his spouting wrist with dull surprise.
Yes!
Her face shone like a searchlight. Her powerful hands were clasped between her breasts.
It'll be a book just for me, Paul. My payment for nursing you back to health. The one and only copy of the newest Misery book. I'll have something no one else in the world has, no matter how much they might want it. Think of it.
Annie, Misery is dead. But already, incredibly, he was thinking, I could bring her back. The thought filled him with tired revulsion, but no real surprise. After all, a man who could drink from a floor bucket should be capable of a little directed writing.
No, she's not, Annie replied dreamily. Even when I was so mad at you, I knew she wasn't really dead. I knew you couldn't really kill her. Because you're good.
Am I? He said, and looked at the typewriter. It grinned at him. We're going to find out just how good you are, old buddy, it whispered. And then she relaxed and smiled.
I've got a present for you, Paul, she said softly.
And before he could ask her what it was, he wasn't sure he wanted any sort of present from Annie. She went on.
The roads were terribly icy. I almost went off twice. The second time, old Bessie slid all the way around in a circle and kept right on going downhill while she did it.
Annie laughed cheerily.
Then I got stuck in a snowbank. This was around midnight. But a sanding crew from the Eustis Public Works Department came along and helped me out.
Bully for the Eustis Public Works Department, Paul said. But what came out was a badly slurred, Bury for the Eustis Public Works Department.
2 miles in from the county highway. That was the last hard patch. The county highway is Route 9, you know. The road you were on when you had your wreck. They had sanded that one to a fare-thee-well. I stopped where you went off and looked for your car. I knew what I would have to do if I saw it. 'Cause there'd be questions. And I'd be just about the first one they'd ask those questions to, for reasons I think you know.
I'm way ahead of you, Annie, he thought. I examined this whole scenario 3 weeks ago.
One of the reasons I brought you back was because it seemed like more of a coincidence. It seemed more like the hand of Providence.
What seemed like the hand of Providence, Annie? He managed.
Your car was wrecked in almost exactly the same spot where I got rid of that Pomeroy creep, the one who said he was an artist.
She flapped a hand in contempt, shifted her feet, and there was that wooden clunking sound, as if one of them brushed some of whatever it was she had down there on the floor.
I picked him up on my way back from Estes Park. I was there at a ceramic show. I liked little ceramic figurines.
I noticed, Paul said. His voice seemed to come from...
which was extremely rare. But his initial impressions ran deeper than that. Unlike Serena, who was bubbly and chatty and not really his type, Maria was quieter, more contemplative, and obviously intelligent. And now? He observed Maria as she tried to figure out whether she wanted to stay or go, continue the conversation, or say goodbye. He said nothing, giving her room to make her own decision. Instead, he concentrated on the feel of the breeze and the sound of the waves. Staring down the pier, he noticed that most of the people who'd been fishing had cleared out. Those who still remained were packing up their gear and cleaning their catch. Maria leaned a little farther over the railing. The darkening sky cast her face in shadow, making her appear mysterious, unknowable. He watched as she drew a long breath. What other things? She finally asked. Colin smiled inwardly. As much as I enjoy working out, there are times when I'm just not in the mood. But...
Folks, Sheldon has performed heroically today, but this has got to be his last shot. The crowd has fallen silent. He closed his eyes, the sportscaster's voice fading as he listened avidly to the minute rattle of the pin in the lock. Now, here was resistance. The tumbler. He could see it lying in there like a curved foot of a rocking chair, pressing the tongue of the lock, holding it in place, holding him in place. It's strictly Mickey Mouse, Paul. But first I'll put his fingers on it, of course. She smiled at him, a dry, spitless smile. Fingerprints, she said. They'll know he went past my house then, or they'll think they do. That's just as good, isn't it, Paul? His dismay deepened. So they'll go up the road and they won't find him. He'll just be gone. Like those swamis who toot their flutes until ropes come out of baskets, and they climb the ropes and disappear. Poof. Poof, Paul said. It won't take them long to come back. I know that. After all, if they can't find any trace of him except that one bottle after here, they'll decide they better think some more about me. After all, I'm crazy, aren't I? All the papers said so. Nutty as a fruitcake. But they'll believe me at first. I don't think they'll actually want to come in and search the house. Not at first. Just stay cool. When you hurt this badly, it was hard to stay cool. He grasped the doorknob with his left hand, reaching under his right arm to do it, and began to apply gentle pressure to the bobby pin. A little more. A little more. In his mind, he could see the rocker beginning to move in its dusty little alcove. He could see the lock's tongue begin to retract. No need for it to go all the way, good God, no. No need to overturn the rocking chair, to use Tom Twyford's metaphor. Just the instant it cleared the doorframe. A push. The pin was simultaneously starting to bend and slip. He felt it happening, and in desperation he pushed upward as hard as he could, turned the knob, and shoved the door. There was a snap as the pin broke in two, the part in the lock falling in, and he had a dull moment to consider his failure before he saw that the door was slowly swinging open with the tongue of the lock sticking. They'll look in other places. Try to think of other things before they come back. We'll have some time. Maybe as much as a week. She looked at him levelly. You're going to have to write faster, Paul, she said. Dark fell and no police came. Annie did not spend the time before it did with Paul, however. She wanted to reglaze his bedroom window and pick up the paper clips and broken glass scattered on the lawn. When the police come tomorrow looking for their missing lamb, she said, we don't want them to see anything out of the ordinary, do we, Paul? Just let them look under the lawnmower, kiddo. Just let them look under there, and they'll see plenty out of the ordinary. But no matter how hard he tried to make his vivid imagination work, he could not make it come up with a scenario which would lead up to that. You wonder why I told you all of this, Paul? She asked, before going upstairs to see what she could do with the window. Why I went into my plans for dealing with this in such great detail. No, he said wanly. Partly because I wanted you to know exactly what the stakes are, and exactly what you'll have to do to stay alive. I also wanted you to know I'd end it right now, except for the book. I still care about the book. She smiled. It was a smile which was both radiant and strangely wistful. It really is the best misery story of them all. And I do so much want to know how it all comes out. So do I, Annie, he said. She looked at him, startled. Why? You know, don't you?
When I start a book, I always think I know how things will turn out. But I never actually had one end exactly that way. It isn't even that surprising once you stop to think about it. Writing a book is a little like firing an ice...
Knowing that I have a match coming up and knowing I have to train for it gets me off the couch and into the gym. Every day? He nodded. Usually two or three different sessions. It takes a lot of time. What do you do? Almost anything, he said with a shrug. A big chunk of my training is centered around striking and grappling, but after that I try to mix it up as much as I can. I do Olympic and heavy lifting, but I also do spin classes, yoga, kayaking, circuit work, running, rope climbs, stairs, plyometrics, bodyweight exercises, whatever. As long as I can break a sweat, I'm happy. You do yoga? It's not only good for flexibility and balance, but it's great for me mentally. It's like meditating. He nodded at the water, burnished red gold in the last rays of the sun. Kind of like being out here after a shift. She squinted at him. You don't look like a guy who does yoga. Guys who do yoga are... He finished for her. Skinny, bearded, into things like...
Yes! Annie, I don't know if I can sit in that wheelchair. Last time it hurt, you bet it did. And it will hurt the next time, too. Maybe even a little more. But there will come a day, and it won't be long either, although it may seem longer to you than it really is, when it hurts a little less, and a little less, and a little less. Annie, will you tell me one thing?
Of course, dear.
If I write this story for you...
Novel! A nice big one like all the others, maybe even bigger.
He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them. Okay, if I write this novel for you, will you let me go when it's done? For a moment, unease slipped cloudily across her face, and then she was looking at him carefully, studiously.
You speak as though I were keeping you prisoner, Paul.
He said nothing, only looked at her.
I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again,
she said.
Is that what you want to hear?
That's what I wanted to hear, yes.
Well, honestly, I knew writers were supposed to have big egos, but I guess I didn't understand that meant ingratitude, too.
He went on looking at her, and after a moment she looked away, impatient and a little flustered. At last he said,
I'll need all the misery books if you've got them, because I don't have my concordance. Of course I have them, she said. Then, what's a concordance?
It's a loose-leaf binder where I have all my misery stuff, he said. Characters and places mostly, but cross-indexed three or four different ways. Timelines, historical stuff. He saw she was barely listening. This was the second time she'd shown not the slightest interest in a trick of the trade that would have held a class of would-be writers spelling out of the plate like a steel finger. Jesus, he whispered. Jesus, thank you.
Let's go to the videotape!
Warner Wolf screamed exultantly in his mind, as the thousands in Annie Wilkes Stadium, not to mention the untold millions watching at home, broke into thunderous cheers.
Not now, Warner,
he croaked, and began the long, draining job of backing and filling the wheelchair so he could get a straight shot at the door. He had a bad, no, not just bad, terrible, horrible moment when it seemed the wheelchair was not going to fit. It was no more than 2 inches too wide, but that was 2 inches too much. She brought it in collapsed. That's why you thought it was a shopping cart at first, his mind informed him drearily. In the end, he was able to squeeze through, barely, by positioning himself squarely in the doorway and then leaning forward enough to grab the jambs of the door in his hands. The axle caps of the wheels squalled against the wood, but he was able to get through. After he did, he grayed out again. Her voice called him out of his daze. He opened his eyes and saw she was pointing a shotgun at him. Her eyes glittered furiously. Spit shone on her teeth.
If you want your freedom so badly, Paul, Annie said, I'll be happy to grant it to you.
She pulled back both hammers. He jerked, expecting the shotgun blast. But she wasn't there, of course. His mind had already recognized the dream. Not a dream, a warning. She could come back at any time. Any time at all. The quality of the light fanning through the half-open bathroom door had changed, grown brighter. It looked like noon light. He wished the clock would chime and tell him just how close to right he was, but the clock was obstinately silent. She stayed away 50 hours before. Light years away. Captain Kirk. There's a voice coming in over the subetheric, he thought, and chuckled dimly. That deep part of him, the part the dope couldn't reach, tried to warn him to shut his mouth, just shut it. But what was the sense? She knew. Of course she knows. The Burka Bee goddess knows everything. I particularly like the penguin on the block of ice.
Thank you, Paul. He is cute, isn't he? Pomeroy was hitchhiking. He had a pack on his back. He said he was an artist. Though I found out later he was nothing but a hippie dope fiend dirty bird who'd been washing dishes in an Estes Park restaurant for the last couple of months. When I told him I had a place in Sidewinder, he said that was a real coincidence. He said he was going to Sidewinder. He said he'd gotten an assignment from a magazine in New York. He was going to go up to the old hotel and sketch the ruins. His pictures were going to be with an article they were doing. It was a famous old hotel called the Overlook, burned down 10 years ago. Caretaker burned it down. He was crazy. Everybody in town said so. Never mind. He's dead. I let Pomeroy stay here with me. We were lovers.
She looked at him with her black eyes burning in her solid yet doughy white face. And Paul thought, if Andrew Pomeroy could get it up for you, Annie, he must have been as crazy as the caretaker that burned down the hotel.
And I found out that he didn't really have an assignment to draw pictures of the hotel at all. He was just doing them on his own, hoping to sell them. He wasn't even sure the magazine was doing an article on the Overlook. I found that out pretty quick. After I did, I sneaked a look at his sketchpad. I felt I had a perfect right to do that. After all, he was eating my food and sleeping in my bed. There were only 8 or 9 pictures in the whole book, and they were terrible.
Her face wrinkled, and for a moment she looked as she had when she had imitated the sound the pig made.
I could have made better pictures.
Lens and beads? She laughed. I was going to say they're usually not into violence. Well, neither am I. Not anymore. Obviously, injuries can happen during one of my fights, but I don't necessarily want to hurt anyone. I just want to win. Don't the two go together? Sometimes, but not always. If you get your opponents in the right submission hold, they'll tap out and walk away good as new. She twirled the bracelet on her wrist. Is it scary, walking into that cage? If you're scared, you probably shouldn't be getting into the ring in the first place. For me, it's more of a rush that gets the adrenaline flowing. The key is to keep the adrenaline under control. He began reeling in his line. I take it you're pretty good. I'm all right for an amateur, but I'd struggle in the pros. Some of those guys were NCAA-level wrestlers or Olympic boxers, and they're out of my league. But I'm fine with that. It's not my dream to go pro. It's just something to do until I graduate.
The reason, he thought, was simplicity itself. Annie Wilkes was the perfect audience, a woman who loves stories without having the slightest interest in the mechanics of making them. She was the embodiment of that Victorian archetype, constant reader. She did not want to hear about his concordance and indices, because to her, misery and the characters surrounding her were perfectly real. Indices meant nothing to her. If he had spoken of a village census in Little Dunthorpe, she might have showed some interest.
I'll make sure you get the books. They're a little dog-eared, but that's a sign a book has been well-read and well-loved, isn't it?
Yes, he said. No need to lie this time. Yes, it is.
I'm going to study up on bookbinding, she said dreamily. I'm going to bind Misery's Return myself. Except for my mother's Bible, it'll be the only real book I own.
That's good, he said, just to say something. He was feeling a little sick to his stomach.
I'll go out now so you can put on your thinking cap, she said. This is exciting, don't you think so?
Yes, Annie, I sure do.
I'll be in with some breasted chicken and mashed potatoes and peas for you in half an hour. Even a little jello, because you've been such a good boy. And I'll make sure you get your pain medication right on time. You can even have an extra pill in the night if you need it. I want to make sure you get your sleep, because you have to go back to work tomorrow. You'll mend faster when you're working, I bet.
She went to the door, paused there for a moment, and then grotesquely blew him a kiss. The door closed behind her. He did not want to look at the typewriter and for a while resisted, but at last his eyes rolled helplessly toward it. It sat on the bureau, grinning. Looking at it was a little like looking at an instrument of torture, boot, rack, strappado, which is standing inactive, but only for the moment.
I think that by the time you finish, you should be...
So she did. And she might stay away 80 this time. Or you might hear that Cherokee pulling in 5 seconds from now. In case you didn't know it, friend, the Weather Bureau can post tornado warnings. But when it comes to telling exactly when and where they'll touch down, you don't know fuck all. True enough, he said, and rolled the wheelchair down to the bathroom. Looking in, he saw an austere room floored with hexagonal white tiles. A bathtub with rusty fans spreading below the faucet stood on clawed feet. Beside it was a linen closet. Across from the tub was a sink. Over the sink was a medicine cabinet. The floor bucket was in the tub. He could see its plastic top. The hall was wide enough for him to swing the chair around and face the door, but now his arms were trembling with exhaustion. He had been a puny kid, and so he had tried to take reasonably good care of himself as an adult. But his muscles were now the muscles of an invalid, and the puny kid was back, as if all that time spent doing laps and jogging and working out on the Nautilus machine had been only a dream. At least this doorway was wider. Not much, but enough to make his passage less hair-raising. Paul bumped over the lintel, and then the chair's hard rubber wheels rolled smoothly over the tiles. He smelled something sour that he automatically associated with hospitals. Lysol, maybe. There was no toilet in here, but he had already suspected that. The only flushing sounds came from upstairs, and now that he thought of it, one of those upstairs flushes always followed his use of the bedpan. Here there was only the tub, the basin, and the linen closet with its door standing open. He gazed briefly at the neat piles of blue towels and washcloths. He was familiar with both from the sponge bath she had given him, and then turned his attention to the medicine cabinet over the washstand. It was out of reach. No matter how much he...
When the time comes, I'll be ready to walk away. Instead of casting again, he fastened the hook and lure to the pole, then tightened the line. And besides, teaching and cage fighting don't exactly mesh. I'd probably scare the little kids like I scared you. Little kids? I want to teach third grade, he said. He bent over, reaching for his tackle box. It's getting dark, he added. You ready to head back, or would you like to stay out here a bit longer? We can go, she said. As Colin set the pole on his shoulder, she noted the restaurants lit from within, lines of people already forming at the doors, the faint strains of music filling the air. It's starting to get crowded down here. That's why I asked to work the day shift. It'll be a zoo on the rooftop tonight. Good for tips, no? Not worth the aggravation. Too many college kids. She laughed, the sound warm and melodic. They began to retrace the steps they'd taken earlier, neither feeling the need to rush. In the dimming light, she was...
BM. Only it travels over time instead of space. The book time the characters spend living in the story, and the real time the novelist spends writing it all down. Having a novel end exactly the way you thought it would when you started out would be like shooting a Titan missile halfway around the world and having the payload drop through a basketball hoop. Looks good on paper. There are people who build those things who tell you it was easy as pie, and even kept a straight face while they said it. But the odds are always against. Yes, Annie said. I see. I must have a pretty good navigation system built into the equipment, because I usually get close. If you have enough high explosives packed into the nose cone, close is good enough. Right now I see two possible endings to the book. One is very sad. The other, while not your standard Hollywood happy ending, at least holds out some hope for the future. Annie looked alarmed, and suddenly thunderous.
You're not thinking of killing her again, are you, Paul?
He smiled a little. What would you do if I did, Annie? Kill me? That doesn't scare me a bit. I may not know what's going to happen to Misery, but I know what's going to happen to me. And you. I'll write the end, and you'll read. And then you'll write the end, won't you? The end of us. That's one I don't have to guess at. Truth really isn't stranger than fiction, no matter what they say. Most times you know exactly how things are going to turn out. But I think I know which ending it's going to be. I'm about 80% sure to the strain of meeting people again. Oh, Annie, you were lying to both of us. I knew it and you did too. I saw it in your eyes. The limited vista now opening before him was extremely unpleasant. 6 weeks of life which he would spend suffering with his broken bones and renewing his acquaintance with Misery Chastain, nay, Carmichael, followed by a hasty internment in the backyard. Or perhaps she would feed his remains to Misery the pig. That would have a certain justice, black and gruesome though it might be. Then don't do it. Make her mad. She's like a walking bottle of nitroglycerin as it is. Bounce her around a little. Make her explode. Better than lying here suffering. He tried looking up at the interlocked W's, but all too soon he was looking at the typewriter again. It stood atop the bureau, mute and thick and full of words he did not want to write, grinning with its one missing tooth. I don't think you believe that, old buddy. I think you want to stay alive even if it does hurt. If it means bringing Misery back for an encore, you'll do it. You try, anyway. But first you're going to have to deal with me. And I don't think I like your face. Makes us even, Paul croaked. This time he tried looking out the window, where fresh snow was falling. Soon enough, however, he was looking at the typewriter again, with avid, repulsed fascination, not even aware of just when his gaze had shifted. Getting into the chair didn't hurt as much as he had feared, and that was good, because previous experience had shown him that he could hurt plenty afterwards. She set the tray of food down on the bureau, then rolled the wheelchair over to the bed. She helped him to sit up. There was a dull, thudding flare of pain in his pelvic area, but it subsided. And then she leaned over, the side of her neck pressing against his shoulder like the neck of a horse.
He came in while I was looking, and he got mad. He said I was snooping. I said I didn't call looking at things in my own house snooping. I said if he was an artist, I was Madame Curie. He started to laugh. He laughed at me. So
You killed him, Paul said. His voice sounded dim and ancient. She smiled uneasily at the wall.
Well, I guess it was something like that. I don't remember very well. Just when he was dead. I remember that. I remember giving him a bath.
He stared at her and felt a sick, soupy horror. The image came to him. Pomeroy's naked body floating in the downstairs tub like a piece of raw dough, head reclining aslant against the porcelain, open eyes staring up at the ceiling.
I had to, she said. lips drawing back a bit from her teeth. You probably don't know what the police can do with just one piece of thread, or dirt under someone's fingernails, or even dust in a corpse's hair. You don't know, but I worked in hospitals all my life, and I do know. I do know. I know about forensics.
She was working herself into one of her patented Annie Wilkes frenzies, and he knew he should try and say something which would at least temporarily defuse her. But his mouth seemed numb and useless.
They're out to get me. All of them. Do you think they would have listened if I tried to tell them how it was? Do you? Do you? Oh, no. They'd probably say something crazy like I made a pass at him, and he laughed at me, so I killed him. They'd probably say something like that.
And you know what, Annie? You know what? I think that just might be a little closer to the truth.
The dirty birdies around here would say anything to get me in trouble or smear my name.
She paused, not quite panting but breathing hard.
Alluring, her slight smile making him wonder what she was thinking. Have you always lived here? He asked, breaking the peaceful lull. I grew up here and moved back last December, she answered. Between college, law school, and working in Charlotte, I was gone for about 10 years. You're not from here, though, right? I'm from Raleigh, he said. Spent summers here when I was a kid, lived here on and off for a month or two for a few years after high school. I've been living here permanently the last 3 years. We've probably been neighbors at times and didn't even know it. I went to UNC and Duke. Neighbors or not, I doubt we traveled in the same social circles. She smiled. So, you came here to go to college? Not at first. College came a little after that. I came here because my parents kicked me out of the house and I wasn't sure where else to go. My friend Evan was living here and I ended up renting a room from him. Your parents kicked you out? He nodded. I needed a wake-up call. They gave me one.
Strained, it was a good 9 inches above the tips of his fingers. He could see this, but reached anyway, unable to believe fate or God or whoever could be so cruel. He looked like an outfielder reaching desperately for a home run ball he had absolutely no chance of catching. Paul made a wounded, baffled noise, lowered his hand, and then leaned back, panting. The gray cloud lowered. He willed it away and looked around for something he could use to open the medicine cabinet's door, and saw an O-cedar mop leaning stiffly in the corner on a long blue pole. You gonna use that? Really? Well, I guess you could. Pry open the medicine cabinet door and then just knock a bunch of stuff out into the basin. But the bottles will break. And even if there are no bottles, fat chance. Everyone has at least a bottle of Listerine or Scope or something in their medicine cabinet. You have no way of putting back what you knocked down. So when she comes back and sees the mess, what then? I'll tell her it was misery, he croaked. I'll tell her she dropped by looking for a tonic to bring her back from the dead. Then he burst into tears. But even through the tears, his eyes were conning the room, looking for something, anything, inspiration, a break, just a fucking break. He was looking into the linen closet again, and his rapid breath suddenly stopped. His eyes widened. His first cursory glance had taken in the shelves with their stacks of folded sheets and pillowcases and washcloths and towels. Now he looked at the floor, and on the floor were a number of square cardboard cartons. Some were labeled Upjohn. Some were labeled Lily. Some were labeled Cam Pharmaceuticals. He turned the wheelchair roughly, hurting himself, not caring. Please, God, don't let it be her cash of extra shampoo or her tampons or pictures of her dear old sainted mother or... He fumbled for one of the boxes, dragged it out, and opened the flap. He could feel the thump of her pulse, and his face twisted in revulsion. Then her right arm was firmly around his back, her left under his buttocks. Try not to move from the knees while I do this, she said, and then simply slid him into the chair. She did it with the ease of a woman sliding a book into an empty slot in her bookcase. Yes, she was strong. Even in good shape, the outcome of a fight between him and Annie would have been in doubt. And as he was now, it would be like Wally Cox taking on Boom Boom Mancini.
She put the board in front of him.
Just wait outside a second.
I stood and left the confessional. Sister James came toward me from where she'd been standing against the wall.
That wasn't so bad now, was it? She asked.
I'm supposed to wait, I told her. She looked at me. I could see she was curious, but she didn't ask any questions. The priest came out soon after. He was old and very tall and walked with a limp. He stood close beside me, and when I looked up at him, I saw the white hair in his nostrils. He smelled strongly of tobacco.
We had a little trouble getting started, he said.
Yes, Father?
He's just a bit nervous, is all, the priest said. Needs to relax. Nothing like a glass of milk for that.
She nodded.
Why don't we try again a little later? Say, 20 minutes?
We'll be here, Father.
Sister James and I went to the rectory kitchen. I sat at a steel cutting table while she poured me a glass of milk.
You want some cookies? She asked.
That's all right, sister.
Sure you do.
She put a package of Oreos on a plate and brought it to me. Then she sat down. With her arms crossed, hands hidden in her sleeves, she watched me eat and drink. Finally, she said,
What happened then? Cat get your tongue?
Yes, sister.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
I know.
Maybe you're just thinking of it wrong, she said.
I stared at my hands on the tabletop.
I forgot to give you a napkin, she said.
Go on and lick them. Don't be shy.
She waited until I looked up, and when I did, I saw that she was younger than I'd thought her to be. Not that I'd given much thought to her age. Except for the really old nuns with canes or facial hair, they all seemed outside of time, without past or future. But now, forced to look at Sister James across the narrow space of this gleaming table, I saw her differently. I saw an anxious woman of about my mother's age who wanted to help me without knowing what kind of help I needed. Her goodwill worked strongly on me. My eyes burned and my throat swelled up. I would have surrendered to her if I'd only known how.
It probably isn't as bad as you think it is, Sister James said. Whatever it is, someday you'll look back and you'll see that it was natural. But you've got to bring it to the light. Keeping it in the dark is what makes it feel so bad.
She added,
I'm not asking you to tell me, understand? That's not my place. I'm just saying that we all go through these things.
Sister James leaned forward over the table.
When I was your age, she said, maybe even a little older, I used to go through my father's wallet while he was taking his bath at night. I didn't take bills, just pennies and nickels, maybe a dime. Nothing he'd miss. My father would have given me the money if I'd asked for it, but I preferred to steal it. Stealing from him made me feel awful, but I did it all the same.
She looked down at the tabletop.
I was a backbiter, too. Whenever I was with one friend, I would say terrible things about my other friends, and then turn around and do the same thing to the one I had just been with. I knew what I was doing, too. I hated myself for it, I really did. But that didn't stop me. I used to wish that my mother and my brothers would die in a car crash so I could grow up with just my father and have everyone feel sorry for me.
Sister James shook her head.
I had all these bad thoughts I didn't want to let go of. Know what I mean?
I nodded and presented her with an expression that was meant to register dawning comprehension.
Good, she said.
She slapped her palms down on the table.
Ready to try again? I said that I was. Sister James led me back to the confessional. I knelt and began again. Bless me, Father, for...
All right, he said. We've been here before. Just talk plain.
Yes, Father. Again, I closed my eyes over my folded hands.
Come, come,
he said with a certain sharpness. Yes, Father. I bent close to the screen and whispered, Father, I steal. He was silent for a moment. Then he said,
What do you steal?
I steal money, Father, from my mother's purse when she's in the shower.
How long have you been doing this?
I didn't answer.
Well, he said, a week, a year, 2 years?
I chose the one in the middle. A year?
A year, he repeated. That won't do. You have to stop. Do you intend to stop?
Yes, Father.
Honestly, no.
Honestly, Father.
All right. Good. What else?
I'm a backbiter.
A backbiter?
I say things about my friends when they're not around.
That won't do either, he said.
No, Father.
That certainly won't do. Your friends will desert you if you persist in this. And let me tell you, a life without friends is no life at all.
Yes, Father.
Do you sincerely intend to stop?
Yes, Father.
Good. Be sure that you do. I tell you this in all seriousness. Anything else?
I have bad thoughts, Father.
Yes. Well, he said, why don't we save those for next time? You have enough to work on.
The priest gave me my penance and absolved me. As I left the confessional, I heard his own door open and close. Sister James came forward to meet me again, and we waited together as the priest made his way to where we stood. Breathing hoarsely, he steadied himself against a pillar. He laid his other hand on my shoulder.
That was fine, he said. Just fine.
He gave my shoulder a squeeze.
You have a fine boy here, Sister James.
She smiled. So I do, Father. So I do. Just after Easter, Roy gave me the Winchester 22 rifle I'd learned to shoot with. It was a light, pump-action, beautifully balanced piece with a walnut stock, black from all its oilings. Roy had carried it when he was a boy, and it was still as good as new. Better than new. The action was silky from long use, and the wood of a quality no longer to be found. The gift did not come as a surprise. Roy was stingy and slow to take a hint, but I'd put him under siege. I had my heart set on that rifle. A weapon was the first condition of self-sufficiency and of being a real Westerner, and of all acceptable employment, trapping, riding herd, soldiering, law enforcement, and outlawry. I needed that rifle, for itself, and for the way it completed me when I held it. My mother said I couldn't have it. Absolutely not. Roy took the rifle back, but promised me he'd bring her around. He could not imagine anyone refusing him anything, and treated the refusals he did encounter as perverse and insincere. Normally mute, he became at these times a relentless whiner. He would follow my mother from room to room, emitting one ceaseless note of complaint that was pitched perfectly to jelly her nerves and bring her to a state where she would agree to anything to make it stop. After a few days of this, my mother caved in. She said I could have the rifle if, and only if, I promised never to take it out or even touch it except when she and Roy were with me. Okay, I said. Sure. Naturally. But even then, she wasn't satisfied. She plain didn't like the fact of me owning a rifle. Roy said he had owned several rifles by the time he was my age, but this did not reassure her. She didn't think I could be trusted with it. Roy said, now was the time to find out. For a week or so, I kept my promises. But now that the weather had turned warm, Roy was usually off somewhere, and eventually, in the dead hours after school, when I found myself alone in the apartment, I decided that there couldn't be any harm in taking the rifle out to clean it. Only to clean it, nothing more. I was sure it would be enough just to break it down, oil it, rub linseed into the stock, polish the octagonal barrel, and then hold it up to the light to confirm the perfection of the bore. But it wasn't enough. From cleaning the rifle, I went to marching around the apartment with it, and then to striking brave poses in front of the mirror. Roy had saved one of his army uniforms, and I sometimes dressed up in this, together with martial-looking articles of hunting gear, fur trooper's hat, camouflage coat, boots that reached nearly to my knees. The camouflage coat made me feel like a sniper, and before long, I began to act like one. I set up a nest on the couch by the front window. I drew the shades to darken the apartment and took up my position. Nudging the shade aside with the rifle barrel, I followed people in my sights as they walked or drove along the street. At first, I made shooting sounds. Cue, cue. Then I started cocking the hammer and letting it snap down. Roy stored his ammunition in a metal box he kept hidden in the closet. As with everything else hidden in the apartment, I knew exactly where to find it. There was a layer of loose 22 rounds on the bottom of the box under shells of bigger caliber, dropped there by the handful, the way men drop pennies on their dressers at night. I took some and put them in a hiding place of my own. With these, I started loading up the rifle. Hammer cocked, around in the chamber, finger resting lightly on the trigger, I drew a bead on whoever walked by. Women pushing strollers, children, garbage collectors, laughing and calling to each other, anyone. And as they passed under my window, I sometimes had to bite my lip to keep from laughing in the ecstasy of my power over them, and at their absurd and innocent belief that they were safe. But over time, the innocence I laughed at began to irritate me. It was a peculiar kind of irritation. I saw it years later in men I served with, and felt it myself, when unarmed Vietnamese civilians talked back to us while we were herding them around. Power can be enjoyed only when it is recognized and feared. Fearlessness in those without power is maddening to those who have it. One afternoon, I pulled the trigger. I had been aiming at two old people, a man and a woman, who walked so slowly that by the time they turned the corner at the bottom of the hill, my little store of self-control was exhausted. I had to shoot. I looked up and down the street. It was empty. Nothing moved but a pair of squirrels chasing each other back and forth on the telephone wires. I followed one in my sights. Finally, it stopped for a moment, and I fired. The squirrel dropped straight into the road. I pulled back into the shadows and waited for something to happen, sure that someone must have heard the shot
or seen the squirrel fall. But the sound that was so loud to me probably seemed to our neighbors no more than the bang of a cupboard slammed shut. After a while, I sneaked a glance into the street. The squirrel hadn't moved. It looked like a scarf someone had dropped. When my mother got home from work, I told her there was a dead squirrel in the street. Like me, she was an animal lover. She took a cellophane bag off a loaf of bread, and we went outside and looked at the squirrel.
"Poor little thing," she said.
She stuck her hand in the wrapper and picked up the squirrel, then pulled the bag inside out, away from her hand. We buried it behind our building, under a cross made of popsicle sticks, and I blubbered the whole time. I blubbered again in bed that night. At last I got out of bed and knelt down and did an imitation of somebody praying. And then I did an imitation of somebody receiving divine reassurance and inspiration. I stopped crying. I smiled to myself and forced a feeling of warmth into my chest. Then I climbed back in bed and looked up at the ceiling with a blissful expression until I went to sleep. For several days, I stayed away from the apartment at times when I knew I'd be alone there. I resumed my old patrol around the city or fooled around with my Mormon friends. One of these was a boy who'd caught everyone's notice on the first day of school by yelling when a classmate named Boone had his name read out, "Hey, any relation to Daniel?" His own name was called soon after, and this turned out to be Crockett. He seemed puzzled by the hoots of laughter that followed. Not angry, just puzzled. His father was a jocular man who liked children and used to take mobs of us swimming at the Y and to youth concerts given by the Tabernacle Choir. Mr. Crockett later became a justice of the state Supreme Court, the same one that granted Gary Gilmore his wish to die. Though I avoided the apartment, I could not shake the idea that sooner or later I would get the rifle out again. All my images of myself as I wished to be were images of myself armed. Because I did not know who I was, any image of myself, no matter how grotesque, had power over me. This much I understand now. But the man can give no help to the boy, not in this matter, nor in those that follow. The boy moves always out of reach. One afternoon, I walked a friend of mine to his house. After he went inside, I sat on his steps for a while, then got to my feet and started toward home, walking fast. The apartment was empty. I took the rifle out and cleaned it, put it back, ate a sandwich, took the rifle out again. Though I didn't load it, I did turn the lights off and pull down the shades and assume my position on the couch. I stayed away for several days after that. Then I came back again. For an hour or so, I aimed at people passing by. Again, I teased myself by leaving the rifle unloaded, snapping the hammer on air, trying my own patience like a loose tooth. I had just followed a car out of sight when another car turned the corner at the bottom of the hill. I zeroed in on it, then lowered the rifle. I don't know whether I had ever seen this particular car before, but it was of a type and color, big, plain blue, usually driven only by government workers and nuns. You could tell if it was nuns by the way their headgear filled the windows, and by the way they drove, which was very slowly and anxiously. Even from a distance, you could feel the tension radiating from a car full of nuns. The car crept up the hill. It moved even slower as it approached my building, and then it stopped. The front door on the passenger side opened, and Sister James got out. I drew back from the window. When I looked out again, the car was still there, but Sister James was not. I knew that the apartment door was locked. I always locked it when I took the rifle out, but I went over and double-checked it anyway. I heard her coming up the steps. She was whistling. She stopped outside the door and knocked. It was an imperative knock. She continued to whistle as she waited. She knocked again. I stayed where I was, still and silent, rifle in hand, afraid that Sister James would somehow pass through the locked door and discover me. What would she think? What would she make of the rifle, the fur hat, the uniform, the darkened room? What would she make of me? I feared her disapproval, but even more than that, I feared her incomprehension, even her amusement at what she could not possibly understand. I didn't understand it myself. Being so close to so much robust identity, it made me feel the poverty of my own, the ludicrous aspect of my costume and props. I didn't want to let her in. At the same time, strangely, I did. After a few moments of this, an envelope slid under the door, and I heard Sister James going back down the steps. I went to the window and saw her bend low to enter the car, lifting her habit with one hand and reaching inside with the other. She arranged herself on the seat, closed the door, and the car started slowly up the hill. I never saw her again. The envelope was addressed to Mrs. Wolfe. I tore it open and read the note. Sister James wanted my mother to call her. I burned the envelope and note in the sink and washed the ashes down the drain. Roy was tying flies at the kitchen table. I was drinking a Pepsi and watching him. He bent close to his work, grunting with concentration. He said, in an offhand way, "What do you think about a little brother?"
"A little brother?"
He nodded.
"Me and your mom have been thinking about starting a family."
I didn't like this idea at all. In fact, it froze me solid. He looked up from the vise.
"We're already pretty much of a family when you think about it," he said.
I said I guessed we were.
"We have a lot of fun."
He looked down at the vise again.
"A lot of fun. We're thinking about it," he said. "Nothing like a little guy around the house. You could teach him things. You could teach him to shoot."
I nodded.
"That's what we were thinking, too," he said. "I don't know about names, though. What do you think of Bill as a name?"
I said I liked it.
"Bill," Roy said. "Bill. Bill."
He turned silent again, staring down at the fly in the vise, his hands on the table. I finished off my Pepsi and went outside. While my mother and I ate breakfast the next morning, Roy carried fishing gear and camping equipment out to the Jeep. He was lashing down something in back when I left for school. I yelled, "Good luck," and he waved at me, and I never saw him again either. My mother was in the apartment when I got home that day, folding clothes into a suitcase that lay open on her bed. Two other suitcases were already packed full. She was singing to herself. Her color was high, her movements quick and sure, everything about her flushed with gaiety. I knew we were on our way the moment I heard her voice.
even before I saw the suitcases.
She asked me why I wasn't at archery. There was no suspicion behind the question. They canceled it, I told her. Great, she said. Now I won't have to go looking for you. Why don't you check your room and make sure I've got everything? We going somewhere? Yes. She smoothed out a dress.